It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air.
Well, good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to the 109th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. My most recent piece for Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. That's WESTCHESTERGUARDIAN.com. It includes the 183rd column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if desire, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is JohnMack. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll also find links to the previous radio shows and to my free online daily newspaper at my web home, which is www.johnmack13.com, obviously spelled the same way. I'm excited about the upcoming series of shows, and starting next week with singer, songwriter, poet, and college professor Susanna Rich. I hope the audience for this show will continue for the upcoming one as well. And now to this show, the 109th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to the conclusion of my interviews with my guests. My guests tonight are three veterans in various times of their lives in Latin America. Jim Taylor spent 10 years working for the Inter-American Bank. Journalist Karen DeWitt spent time there covering various armed conflicts. And Rob, here we go again, we're contents. Tell me how to get say it again, Rob, please.
Mercatante.
Mercatante. Has
very good.
The last 25 years of his life working for various groups in Guatemala. It seems to me that both Latin and South America have gotten short shift in both our education and news coverage. My memory of world history and grammar in high schools was really European history. The lower Americas were just places the colonists came to and took over. They only came back to our attention when Castro came to power, or when the Panama Canal was turned over to Panama, or when El Salvador and Nicaragua plunged into revolution. And, of course, now because of the large migration north from refugees from these countries. I've asked tonight's guests, or each previous guest on the show, to flesh out Latin America for us. Each was there at a different time, and none had previously known each other. The URLs for their previous shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, Karen, Jim, and Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll start with brief introductions. Jim Taylor, tell us about yourself and your history in Latin America.
Well, my first experience in Latin America was 2 months in Colombia. As a graduate student, we had a summer seminar in Colombia, first exposure to doing field work. And then I spent 2 years in Nicaragua, between 1965 and 1967, when Anastasio Somoza Debayle was still in power. And I worked with the government on the feasibility of a land settlement project, and I also gathered data for my doctoral thesis, which is on land tenure and agricultural settlement in eastern Nicaragua. I then lived and worked 8 years in southern New Mexico, close to the Mexican border, close enough so that I was able to teach at New Mexico State University during the daytime and occasionally teach a night course on the Mexican side of the border in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua. After that, I spent 19 years with the Inter-American Development Bank, and that gave me a chance to really get to know all of Latin America. I visited 17 of the 19 Spanish-speaking countries in the hemisphere, plus Brazil and Jamaica. doing mostly economic reports for the bank as a background for their lending program. And I also got involved in loan projects, evaluating loan projects, and in cases where the project was a hybrid project that involved policy change plus the physical project itself, I was involved in helping redefine a country's economic policies.
Thank you, Jim. Karen DeWitt, how about you?
I'm very superficial compared to Jim. I was a reporter and covered Panama for USA Today, and so I spent a lot of time in Central America when Noriega was in charge in Panama and the United States was trying to get him out. And then I studied Spanish in Guatemala and in Ecuador, and I know a bit about Haiti because I was down on a project. And I actually am always, when you actually learn things about the United States relationship to Central America, I know less about Latin America, but to Central America, I'm always horrified by the kinds of things that we did to undermine people. And I hope you guys can, the other two people can explain to me why we did certain things. The International Fruit Company in Guatemala, the support for Noriega and then pulling the rug from underneath him, Haiti, which is just, if you want to read anything about our support of any country, it's horrific, starting with Jefferson all the way up to the present.
Karen, didn't you also cover the conflict with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua?
Yes, I did. I was doing it all at the same time. So I covered Panama, Nicaragua, a little bit of what was going in Salvador and Honduras. And it was all in disarray at the time because it was during the Reagan administration and there was big concern about the communist Sandinistas and their influence and Noriega, and it was just wondered what the thinking was and why we were had our fingers in all those pies down there.
Thanks, Karen. How about you, Rob?
Well, my focus gets even more narrow. So going from all of Latin America to a region, mostly Central America, and I can say that I know Guatemala inside and out, but that's definitely been my focus, my home for most of the last 25 years. I came to Guatemala with Habitat for Humanity, thinking that I would do their three-year stint as an international volunteer, helping to run a project on the Guatemalan southern coast. And during that time, just fell madly and passionately in love with the country. And at the same time, saw what the others were referring to, the internal challenges facing the Guatemalan people, a beautiful, hardworking, creative, funny population who were suffering these tremendous violations of their human rights, their economic rights, and having fallen so passionately in love with the country, I wanted to stay and do whatever I could, the little that I could, to try to accompany those who were fighting for a better Guatemala and a better world. And so after Habitat, went through a series of worked with a number of Guatemalan human rights organizations and international human rights organizations. And right now I'm on sabbatical and hopefully returning in January to continue the work there.
Jim, in John Perkins' 2005 book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, he lays a lot of blame on U.S. lending organizations for the poor economies in Latin America by encouraging governments to accept very risky loans and then forcing strict austerity programs on them to escape default, austerity that ensured continuance of poverty. Was Perkins on the right track, or is his analysis overblown?
Well, first of all, I think that he's talking mainly about the International Monetary Fund.
He was, yes. Yes, he was.
Yeah. The International Monetary Fund typically responds to a call for assistance from a country that, because of its own policies and perhaps worldwide economic conditions, gets into trouble. they squander or they run out of foreign exchange. They have an out-of-control inflation problem. They have huge government deficits. So they call the International Monetary Fund. They usually need an injection of dollars because, for one thing, they lack dollars and they can't pay their international debts. Now, I think the International Monetary Fund would accept this criticism that sometimes they've gone too far in the direction of austerity, and they have forced the government to cut across the board its budget. And this has included social programs in the areas of medicine, perhaps education. I think they realize that this has caused undue pain in some circumstances. I wouldn't be surprised if the policies have been somewhat modified. But basically, it's the countries themselves that get into to problems. They may be the victims of low international commodity prices, but many of them have been populist governments that have simply tried to maintain their own popularity by somewhat lavish spending that they really can't afford. And so they call in the doctor. The doctor imposes a diet which is restrictive and painful, and maybe overly so at times.
Rob, what's your take on that?
Well, Guatemala's been a perpetually poor country just because of its backwards tax structure. You don't have the wealthiest families, the biggest businesses in Guatemala paying their fair share. And what we've seen happening is that the struggle to meet the most basic needs, education, healthcare, infrastructure, the government is perpetually short of funds. And part of that's corruption. A great deal of it is that there's just very no income due to the backwards tax structure, one of the most backwards, I think, in the region. And so there's always this need to find some other way of meeting the needs of the country. In Guatemala, we haven't had many populist presidents. In fact, the last popular president, I think, was ousted by a CIA-backed coup. Since then, it's been basically military dictators and extreme right-wing and pro-military presidents. So we haven't had that thing of trying to please the populace by spending too much. It's been quite the opposite. But because there's this huge financial, huge fiscal debt that continuously exists in Guatemala, the look is to the outside then for loans. And in recent years, what has caused tremendous conflict in Guatemala are these, which are hydroelectric dams and massive mining operations, which provide regalias, which provide these percentages that are paid on profits to the government. And when you're perpetually broke, 1%, 2%, 3% of this income from these mining operations or these other major development projects looks pretty good. And so I think that's where Guatemala's gone into itself in the past, into great difficulties, assuming debt that it couldn't pay off, and now opening the doors to these international mining interests and hydroelectric dams just because it's a quick way of receiving income.
Karen, did you cover economic issues when you...
Not very much. I mean, mostly it was all politics. I didn't cover, who was giving money. The only thing I remember was when the United States turned off dollars in Panama. And it was interesting because the Panamanian elite had already taken all their money out of the country and put it in banks in Miami. It's the only time I was ever in a country where I didn't have sympathy for the opposition. Because they're the very poorest people, of course, couldn't do this, that. So they had already exported their money, as it were.
To Karen, for a moment, you cover war down there. How do you prepare to go into the war zone?
Well, the first thing to do, I learned very quickly, was to learn the language and learn Spanish, because I used to use facilitators, and I often was places where I didn't know what was going on. I'm good at language, and so I went to Guatemala and studied Spanish and lived with a Guatemaltecan family for 4 weeks, and that started off my Spanish, and then I did 4 more weeks in Ecuador several years later. But my Spanish is very basic. I used to be able to play cuarente and mixtistas, but I don't think I could do that anymore. But I had enough to be able to say, no soy periodista, I am a reporter.
What were the issues that you covered in these wars?
In Panama, the United States was trying to get Noriega out, and even though they had put Noriega in. In Nicaragua, the United States wanted the Sandinistas, who were quote-unquote communists, out. I've never quite figured out what goes on in Salvador at all. It just seems like chaos. As a matter of fact, one of the nuns who was killed there went to my high school, so that's my only connection there. Just try to really figure out what's going on. I mean, you're in another person's culture. Even though we're near neighbors, people do things very differently. I remember when I was in Panama, there was a restaurant run by a Greek guy, and half the people in the restaurant were anti-Noriega, and the other half were supporting Noriega. I mean, literally, it was just like there was an aisle. And I remember talking to one person who was anti-Noriega, and he said, oh, you need to talk to my cousin. He's a supporter. He's over there on that table. I mean, it's not quite the same thing as you find in our Congress right now. It was sort of amazingly intimate. Everybody had nicknames, which was also something I wasn't used to. Oh, you want to talk to Chi-Chi, and his name would go whatever.
But you always...
In
the Nicaragua and in the El Salvador, were you always with the government troops, or did you have any time with the rebels?
No, in Guatemala, I spent time with the guerrillas up in the Tikal area, which was not a great idea to be there, but I did.
We were told in the U.S. that the Sandinistas were communists, or the least extreme, the left wing is. What was their image on the ground down there?
Well, Americans use the word communist. It's sort of like socialism, and we don't really know what these things mean. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ethiopia, and I remember being back in the United States, and this was after the emperor had been overthrown, and I was having dinner with some people, conservatives. I like to know smart conservatives. And the one guy said to me, it's better if they were dead than red. And I said, what are you talking about? I mean, literally, 215 kilometers from the capital isn't in charge. These countries aren't, you know, it's not like Washington, D.C. does something and Columbus, Ohio knows it. They're structured very differently. They don't have the same kind of communication systems. I mean, I used to have to go and make a two-hour appointment to get a telephone call out. So... To talk about people as being communists, there was an image in the United States, and please correct me if I've misconstrued this, you guys, of sort of Soviet communism, and it's not the same in these other places.
Staying with that topic, in the age of Castro, there's always been a concern that the Castro umbrella would spread over Central America. Jim, is that the real concern when you were there?
Sure. I guess I got involved in Latin America through the Alliance for Progress. I was associated with the University of Wisconsin that received a large grant of money to study land reform and land tenure issues in Latin America. Well, the reason behind that was that, of course, there was fear that the Castro Revolution would be replicated throughout Latin America, and as part of the Cold War, it endangered the United States. So they came up with this idea. It was called the Alliance for Progress. It was like a stool with three legs. One leg was educational reforms. The other was democracy. And the third was land reform. Land reform was a way of breaking up the power monopoly of the landed oligarchy, of providing more economic opportunity for the peasant classes. Unfortunately, this didn't get very far. The reason being that the policymakers in Washington decided that revolution was spreading in different ways in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Argentina, in Chile, and so they adopted a more brutal, a more hard-hitting policy. And in some cases, there was a justification. There were kidnappings, violence taking place throughout the hemisphere. But in some cases, it was overreaction, and it was absolutely brutal. I think Guatemala is a worst case study of how, I think the word genocide has been used, of how hundreds of thousands of people were killed. They happened to get on the wrong side. I don't think it was their fault. That's a long story. In terms of Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, it's a little bit of a complicated story. I bought a book written by a fellow who teaches, I think, at the University of Ohio in Athens, which is a pretty good book. And they make the comment that Karen made that it wasn't Soviet-style communism, and that, in fact, Daniel Ortega, who was the leader of the Sandinistas, was even warned by Castro to not go too far. Don't estrange or offend the United States too much. But he went far enough to offend a lot of Nicaraguans who had supported him. The Sandinista Revolution was supported by businessmen. I met some of them when I was down there, that threw their weight behind the Sandinistas, not knowing what to expect. In a sense, it was like the Cuban Revolution, where people thought Castro was just another guy who wanted democracy. Once he got rid of Batista, the dictator, they'd be like any other democracy. And certainly Cuba was in a position to do that. But then they started imposing policies that surprised people. And you can argue he was forced to do that because of certain U.S. policies that drove him into the Soviet camp. But he said he was always a Marxist, and that may be the case. So in the case of Nicaragua, which I know relatively well, but I don't know everything, I had some interesting conversations down there. I went there for the Inter-American Development Bank to carry out a study of the Nicaraguan economy that the Nicaraguans wanted to use to borrow more money or get grant funds from international institutions and countries. And two of the guys that I worked with had worked under Somoza when I was there, and they were miffed by the fact that people are coming in from Cuba, even from Bulgaria, and the government prized their advice above the advice of Nicaraguans. And Nicaragua had some good technicians, some good economists. Another story I remember pretty well is that on the way back to the United States, I sat next to a woman who, or maybe I wasn't flying back to the United States, maybe I was flying within Nicaragua. I sat next to a woman whose son had been doing some work out in the part of the country where I had done my field research, where the government developed a large-scale agricultural settlement project. And I said to her, well, how does he like it out there? She said, well, it rains a lot. Of course, it's humid tropical rainforest, jungle, and it rains pretty heavy and rains frequently. The other thing she said, was the campesinos are muy celosos. I mean, he's sort of jealous or angry. And I said, over what? She said, well, the government has forced them into collective farming. This is typically done in socialist countries. It's one of the only socialists who didn't do that was Tito in Yugoslavia. He let the farmers keep their own land and sell according to market prices. Collective farming has almost universally been a failure. So I said, well, what's the problem? She said, well, the campesinos said some people work. They don't all work, but they all want to share in the income. So this wasn't going too well. But you cannot accuse the Nicaraguan government of really hardcore communism. But it was enough to scare some people and turn some people off. Ortega now, as I understand it, I haven't been down there for a while, is just kind of an ordinary politician living off his corruption, maybe a little bit of crony capitalism. He does have something very big going. China is going to build, not China, but some Chinese investors are going to build a cross-isthmus Panama, a canal in Nicaragua. The feasibility studies are being carried out. It'll be much bigger than the Panama Canal. If it's successful, it's going to make a big difference in that country. And that's an old dream that was buried years ago. Nicaragua was the original site for the first cross-isthmus canal. It was preferred to Panama. And then history came along, things got gummed up. And now it was a canal built in Panama. That's an intriguing story. But the Nicaraguan government signed something called the Brian Chamorro Treaty. Brian is William Jennings. Chamorro, that's an old oligarchy family name in Nicaragua associated with the Conservative Party. That treaty had a condition to it. Nicaragua was provided a certain sum of money, but on the condition that only the United States could build a canal there. And the reason the United States included that condition was we already had the Panama Canal. We didn't want anybody else to build a canal in Nicaragua that would compete with the Panama Canal. So by having a monopoly over construction there, we assured ourselves that the canal would not be built there. That was one of the conditions that the original Sandino, not the Sandinistas, the original Sandino didn't like. And he went to war against the U.S. Marines. And excuse me if I talk too great a length, John. He's cut me off, but this is a fascinating story. The original Sandino objected to that. He successfully fought the U.S. Marines and the Nicaraguan National Guard for about 6 years until they kind of gave up. But the history of the canal is very important in Nicaraguan history, and they're trying at long last to get a canal through their territory.
Well, is that provision still in the existing treaty, or did it go away when we gave up the Panama Canal?
Yeah, I think it's been abrogated. I don't know exactly when that happened, but we had this long period of dollar diplomacy and gunboat diplomacy, deciding which government would rule in a country and which would not. But some of that changed with World War II, when Franklin Roosevelt abrogated or changed our policy and developed the good neighbor policy. So
okay.
if I'm not, my memory is serving me. The Platt Amendment to the Cuban Constitution was eliminated. That was an amendment that we forced on Cuba. We wouldn't take U.S. Troops out of Cuba after the Spanish-American War until they agreed to that amendment. It gave us a right to unilaterally decide to interfere in the internal affairs of Cuba under various conditions, but it basically created a U.S. protectorate out of Cuba. That was abrogated. The Brian Chamorro Treaty may have been abrogated at the same time for the same reason or before that.
Okay. Rob, Jim's comments on genocide in Guatemala, do you want to pick up on that? Was it this mass genocide?
Yes. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that. But also would like to just kind of make the reference that the communist threat in Guatemala, I think, is one of the biggest all-time historical myths. The Guatemalan Revolutionary Movement, which was known as the URNG, the United Guatemalan Revolutionary Movement, URNG was very much a homegrown movement, and it was all about land reform, indigenous rights, women's rights, about fixing a country which was in dire need of fixing. Land reform in Guatemala has been the taboo subject since the arrival of the Spaniards, but has definitely become worse, I think, with each passing year, to the point where even in recent reports, they say the largest 2.5% of farms in Guatemala occupy 2/3 of all the farmland in the country. And it's this kind of disparate land ownership that was one of the things that was being fought to undo during the revolutionary conflict. And here's where there are lots of interesting stories from the region, but one that we need to know about, one that the United States needs to hear about, and which I, growing up in the States, growing up in New York, and going to school in North Carolina, never heard until I arrived in Guatemala, and certainly learned about this dark and terrible past that we as a country were very much a part of. And that is this land, this unfair land ownership, which has existed for centuries, was finally being addressed in the 1950s by two progressive Guatemalan presidents. But because it was land ownership, one of the things that was being touched on at that time was U.S. economic interests, the United Fruit Company, which owned substantial parts of the country for farming bananas and also the railroad. And when these progressive administrations began to look at ways of redistributing that land amongst the campesinos, the peasant farmers, the leadership of the United Fruit Company stood up and took notice, because it was directly affecting their bottom line. It was basically the Guatemalan government reaching into the pockets of the United Fruit Company to take back some of what was theirs. Unfortunately, the leadership of the United Fruit Company, two of the major players were the Dulles brothers, one who was Secretary of State at the time, and the other one who was the head of the CIA. And this is, again, where now it's no news to us nowadays, but the overlap between economic interests and political interests is a nefarious thing, not only internally here in the United States, but how it impacts other countries. And what happened is that the CIA painted the story of this red menace in Guatemala, where I think even magazines like Reader's Digest and Time Magazine were, running stories about the commie menace in our backyard, all as justification to overthrow the government and basically stop the land reform that was going on at that time, to protect U.S. economic interests in Guatemala. This progressive Guatemalan government was overthrown. And it wasn't just land reform we were talking about. They were in labor rights, doing away with child labor, providing free education, free university education, free access to health care. This is what was on the plate. This is what the agenda of these two progressive governments, these back-to-back administrations that were overthrown by the CIA, spinning Guatemala into the cycle of despair. All the land reform that had been done at that point was taken away. So when I mentioned this 2.5% of the farms owning 2/3 of the arable land, that's from a few years ago, and that's actually a USAID study. So it's not even a radical analysis. It's the U.S. government saying this is the way things are now because we went in and overthrew this progressive government. And the revolutionary movement that started up as a result of that, in up and against that, was a very much a homegrown, had nothing to do with the Soviets. If there was any relationship with Castro, I think it was more on common philosophy more than anything else about what a prosperous and a fair and a just country could look like.
John, could I respond to that, or do you want to give us a chance later?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, land reform is a very touchy issue in Guatemala. A lot of issues are touchy. My first acquaintance with the Guatemalan way of reacting came from a friend of mine, also at the University of Wisconsin, was in Guatemala doing a study on rural labor. His name is Les Schmidt. He's a very nice guy, very very mild-mannered guy.
Right.
He hired a Guatemalan student to help him out with his research. This guy was also a writer for a student newspaper. Apparently the government didn't like some of the things he wrote and had him assassinated. My friend Schmidt was just, you know, flabbergasted. He couldn't believe what happened. That's the kind of country Guatemala is. Now, I don't know if this fellow was assassinated, but there was an ex-Inter-American Bank employee, retired, went back to Guatemala, and wrote or spoke about land reform. I don't know if he was killed, but he was threatened, very threatened or hurt. That is the kind of country it is. If there was a land reform carried out in Guatemala, I'm not sure if Rob is very familiar with it. It wasn't an ice land reform. It took place during World War II, when a lot of coffee growers were expropriated. Rob, are you familiar with that?
A little bit. The coffee growing regions in the Coban, which were mostly German owned.
Yeah. Germans. I think it was because we were at war with Germany, but I think these people were like many German immigrants in Latin America, not the people that came over as refugees from the Nazi regime. They were just settlers. It's kind of German settlers that settled the American Midwest, etc. And because they were German, their lands were confiscated. To add to the already bad land tenure situation in Guatemala, a couple of things made it worse in the 60s and 70s. One was rapid population growth. The second was the rapid expansion of export agriculture, including not just cotton, but cattle. The Central American countries got much larger quotas to sell in the U.S. market. And with these opportunities to export cotton, other crops, sugar, they got sugar quotas because Cuba couldn't export to the United States, cattle. There was a wild stampede for land, and the peasants were just pushed aside.
Right.
In many cases, it's easy to get land in Central America, or it was easy, if you have the right contacts.
Exactly.
And the land records in the government office can easily be tampered with. So
yep.
You can make a claim you don't have legitimately, but you've paid someone off to tamper with the records. This happened big time in Nicaragua. It happened in Guatemala. There's a very excellent book written by a professor at a university, I think it's in North Carolina. It's called Guilford College. It's Export Agriculture and the Crisis in Central America. And it details this process in each country. And there's something about Guatemala. I can't recall it in detail, but there's a place here called Panzos where
Panzos,
some peasants
yeah.
were – pardon me?
Yeah, Panzos.
Panzos, okay.
In the eastern part of the country.
Got together to object or have the government listen to them, and they were slaughtered. And apparently this is one of the things that really galvanized the peasant movement. Now, unfortunately, when these things happen, yeah, there are your friendly neighborhood Marxists that will exert leadership and encourage people. And I don't think these peasants knew anything about Marxism or communism, but
exactly.
They were encouraged to fight, and they had reasons to fight. In some instances, the people that encouraged them were Catholic priests. There was a charismatic movement or a movement of left-wing Catholic priests that encouraged people to fight back. Some of them, like a father in a wonderful man in Colombia that I met, Camilo Torres, were just angry at the oligarchy within their own country, and they encouraged the peasants to fight back. When they did, they got, in many cases, slaughtered, and you had this
right.
kind of genocide that happened in Guatemala. And Guatemala, they killed about 11 or 12 priests during that period. In El Salvador, three nuns were raped and killed. I mean, it's an awful story.
Oh, it is. It is. And but it does have our fingerprints on it, which is why
sure.
it's interesting and urgent, important for us to know the role that we played as a people, as a government, as a people, as a nation, in these histories of our neighboring countries, and even not neighboring countries, but to know that the sudden arrival, say, of immigrants, of Latino immigrants from Central America, isn't completely cut off from the causal effects of our policies in the 40s, the 50s, 60s, and onward, and what had happened even in the 80s. With the arrival of brutal dictators who saw that this movement was growing, this movement you were talking about out in the countryside and mostly indigenous communities who began – the priests, I don't think – well, the way that I've heard it is that it wasn't so much anger at the oligarchy as so much as an awareness of the injustice of it all.
Exactly.
And telling the people that they have a right that they actually have rights to begin with, and they
yeah.
have a right to defend those rights.
Sure.
And so they all played a role in this consciousness raising, people realizing that exploitation isn't a de facto way of living. And so as this movement was growing, these, again, two particularly brutal dictators came in the early 80s. The most well-known, I think, is Rios Montt. And with the full support of Ronald Reagan in the White House, who actually had Rios Montt come and visit him, with the full support, began to massacre the indigenous communities where the insurgents, where the Guatemalan rebels were located.
I could always tell where our fingers were when some new Central American restaurant started here in Washington.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting correlations. No, exactly.
Absolutely. You could always tell where our fingers were. I remember I did one of the earliest stories at the New York Times on the rise in the Latino population, and there was a guy who was from Guatemala who came a shoemaker. Then he brought his wife. Then they brought their children, and he started a shoe shop in the DuPont Circle area called Atlas. I can remember when we started eating, what are those things the Salvadorians?
The pupusas.
Pupusas. There are pupusa places all over the place, and it was all at the point where the highest amount of violence was going on in that country. Suddenly you're seeing pupusa restaurants. Pupusa? I didn't even
right.
know.
This isn't coincidence, folks.
No,
yeah.
Not coincidental. And I agree that it's more complicated than saying, oh, well, these governments were trying to work with democracy and, you know, we somehow intruded on them. It's much more complicated than that. At the same time, most Americans have no idea about the International Fruit Company, of what the United Fruit Company did in Guatemala. As a matter
right.
of fact, the other night I was watching Turner Classic Movies, and they had a little commercial about Guatemala, and it's bananas and how happy the people were to be growing bananas, and I'm sitting there gnashing my teeth thinking, this is the United Fruit Company. This is
right.
not Guatemala.
Yeah, that was the point that I was making earlier, that we were taught, at least I was, and I think Jim was in New York City, and certainly the rest of you, we're taught about European history from the Romans on. But we got very little in Guatemala other than sailing around the Cape, and all of this, and it was we still don't know enough. We know more about the intrigue in the Middle East than we do about what's going on here. The Father Torres, who Jim mentioned, he was one of the priests that were part of the liberation theology movement in the Catholic Church that was resented by some conservatives because they within the church because they thought it was making the church too political. I disagree with them. To Karen, how are you as the female correspondent treated in Central America?
I'm African American, so and people just assumed that I was from that part of the world. I mean, if I was in Panama, people assumed I was from Puerto Rico. If I was in Haiti, people assumed that I was Panamanian. I was anything but. So I didn't have a problem because I was a reporter. You know, I was a periodista, so I didn't seem to get mistreated at all or treated in any way different. And this is a generalization once again, but it's sort of like the Middle East. People ask me about the Middle East or Japan and places like that. Women have a role that you often don't see if you go straight from a U.S. feminism point of view. So that Latin America and Central America, it's families that make decisions, not just simply the man. It's often the women. Women are very important in it. Now, we may not like the way it's done, but they do that. Like in Japan, when I came back to the United States, all my feminist friends said, oh, you know, he's married this woman who went to Harvard, and she has her MBA, and she's walking behind him. But in Japan, the Japanese women control the economy. They're the ones who give their husbands money every day to buy lunch and things like that. Perhaps it's changed, but it came out of the Second World War, where they had to have somebody who monitored the economic situation. So I was treated just like a reporter, like any reporter.
See, I was going to stay with that because I always think that women in Latin America, having the status only one step above those in Middle East. But Rob, when you were with me at Barnes & Noble, you and Renee Destabrooks got into a conversation about women's peace groups, and I was surprised to hear you say how important they've been in Guatemala. Tell us about that impact.
Yeah, well, despite this reigning culture of machismo that does exist in Guatemala, and all that carries with it, looking at women as less, as unable, as not capable, because of this 36-year internal armed conflict that raged in Guatemala and resulted in the death of over 100,000 or 200,000 people, what you ended up with was a culture where women, especially indigenous women, rural women, began to take on leadership positions in part because there was this vacuum where so many men had been massacred, had been killed during the conflict. And in part, some of the women who have risen to these incredible leadership positions in Guatemala rose to those positions because they were seeking their brothers, their sons, their fathers, their husbands, who had been disappeared during the conflict. And so as widows or as family members of the disappeared, these women began to search the police barracks, search the army barracks, go into Guatemala City. And like we heard before, the capital is like almost a different world when you live in rural Guatemala. Guatemala City's is literally otherworldly. And these women would make these trips all to try to find their missing loved ones. And in doing so, became more confident, more aware of how the system works, and it's these women and other women who filled this vacuum, and now, despite the machismo that exists in the country, I'd say most of the leaders that I admire, judges, politicians, authors, playwrights, painters, photographers, they're all women,
exactly.
And they're brilliant. And so they, even within this context of machismo, because of this unique history that Guatemala has, and one of the things we've debated is, would this have happened without the internal armed conflict or not? And that's something for, you know, a couple of beers over a late night discussion.
Joe, if I may comment for a time. Yeah, I've seen the women's issue in Latin America from different perspectives. Women have always been important in what's called the informal sector.
Right. Sure.
Commerce, for example. You go to markets in Nicaragua, And you find the women buying and selling, and they're kind of tough. I mean, they're out there struggling to make a living. One humorous incident happened when I took a trip to the marketplace with the subdirector of the Agrarian Institute in Nicaragua. His name was Montes. Montes is a good fellow, but he insists on being called Dr. Montes, even though he didn't have a doctorate degree. And he drove into this marketplace with a chauffeur-driven vehicle, government plates, and he was looking for a place to park, or his chauffeur was. And the chauffeur parked it right in front of a stall of some market women in spite of their objections. Okay, I guess they assumed that because he was Dr. Montes that they wouldn't mind it. When they came back, they found these women had taken the pails that they were using for evacuation, or whatever you call it, were filled with waste products in their own body, and they dumped them over Dr. Montes' car. That's how much respect they had this government. A couple of other comments are we've had at least two, now I think it's three, Latin American elected women presidents. We've had, of course, Bachelet in Chile, which doesn't surprise me. Chile is a socially very advanced country. But after the Sandinistas left power, the president that was elected was a woman named Violeta Chamorro.
Yes.
And Chamorro was the wife of a very distinguished, well, it's an old family. They were landed oligarchy. They were conservatives. But some of them actually supported the Sandinistas. They hated Somoza so much. Her husband, I forget his first name, but he was the editor of the opposition newspaper, a newspaper that used to smear and ridicule the Somozas all the time. I was surprised the Somozas put up with it. But finally, I think they went too far, and this guy Chamorro was assassinated. And it was kind of a symbol of justice that his wife became the president after the Sandinistas, not after Somoza, but after the Sandinistas left. I think there's a President Kirchner in Argentina right now,
yeah,
who's kind of in hot water. I don't know how she's going to come out of this. The investigation of the role of the Iranians an act of terrorism against a Jewish center in Buenos Aires. She apparently, in return for some favors from the Iranian government, has covered up the investigation, and a guy that contends that he had the goodies on her, a prosecutor, was suddenly assassinated. But at any rate, they've had several female elected presidents.
Yeah, also Costa Rica, Brazil, Dilma, and
yeah.
Guatemala looks like it could be on the verge of electing later on this month their very first woman president.
I hope it's not, well, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I know that one of the candidates is a daughter of Rios Montt. I've heard her on Univision television, and
yes,
she is a well-spoken,
yes,
and somewhat attractive woman. They asked me, "Yeah, but you're the daughter of this guy who was responsible for all these deaths." She said, "I disassociate myself from that." Do you know how she's doing?
Yeah, she's not in the running for president, and I don't believe she was. I don't know if she was running for Congress this time or not. I don't believe so.
Okay, well, Univision interviewed her as if she were a serious candidate for something.
She's,
and they put her on defensive, but she has a certain amount of poise. And
extremely
and smart.
Populist, and but no, definitely not an apologist for her, or definitely an apologist for her father is not. It may have distanced herself from any of the controversy, but definitely has been a complete advocate of him and has said that he's
uh-huh.
done no wrong,
yeah,
denies that genocide ever happened. Very populist. But no, the woman who's the it's a runoff election, and the female candidate is Sandra Torres, who is the wife of, or the ex-wife now, of Alvaro Colom. So, and it's anybody's guess at this point whether she'll be elected or not, but it's just between those two candidates now as
uh-huh.
the runoff.
Will it be more stable now that Matamoros?
Stability in Guatemala, I've never had a really good relationship. And it's a very hard guess because it's very much these problems are structural problems. So you can change the face, but I think until there's serious change to the system itself, we'll have these same repeating problems of corruption and violence and gross violation of human rights. It almost doesn't matter who's sitting in the chair as long as the people who put that person in the chair and keep that person in the chair have the power.
Rob, can I ask Rob a question?
Sure. Go.
Yeah. A comment and a question. Rob, I walk around my neighborhood a lot. It's near Mount Vernon in Fairfax County.
Okay.
And I see a lot of Central Americans doing the hard work, construction, repairs, remodeling, yard work.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I engage them in conversation just because I don't have the opportunity to speak Spanish as often as I used to.
Oh, that's true.
They're refugee Guatemalans. But they don't seem to be the kind of Guatemalans that you see cultivating corn on one of those deep hillsides. In other words, I think they're more upwardly mobile Guatemalans. They may be affected by the violence and lack of economic opportunity. But what's going to happen to these people? We've spoken about the fact that they have so little land. Not only do they have little land, but you'll find them on the deepest hillsides, cultivating any piece of ground they can find. These hillsides are often easily eroded. I understand there's a lot of undernourished. What is going to happen to these people? And does Guatemala have enough resources so that even with the best of in the best of circumstances, with the most well-intended government, can you put a dent in that?
Yeah, well, those are absolutely brilliant questions. Obviously, again, because these problems are structural, because they go to this incredible disparity in wealth, the answer isn't easy. And when you're talking about these people who are farming in these incredibly remote areas, so even getting your food to market or much less the international market, I mean just local market, is an uphill battle, literally an uphill battle. These people have been pushed, many of these, especially indigenous communities, have been pushed to the far corners of these incredibly remote areas, mountainous, rocky, terrible terrain, horrible for cultivating, in which they basically make out a survival living. They farm to eat is basically what it boils down to for many of these communities. The great irony now is that many of these same communities are now being forced off of that land because, guess what, under the soil is silver and gold and other minerals, which these international corporations are interested in mining. And the owner of the subsoil in Guatemala is the Guatemalan government, not the people who own that parcel of land. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing this, again, these people being pushed off, even off of this terrible land, because the new economic interest now is mining. So what are the easy answers? No idea. And could someone with good intentions fix Guatemala? Well, I don't know. There are easy first steps, right? I mean, and one of those things is that an easy first step is getting the wealthy and the international corporations that are working in Guatemala to pay their fair share of taxes. At least then you get money coming back into the system that can be used for educating Guatemalans, because, again, that's one of the major challenges is having a population which is literate, which is educated. It doesn't have to depend on farming corn and beans for survival. So there are steps that can be taken to move Guatemala at least in the right direction that seem fairly obvious and yet don't want to be touched because of the powerful interests that are behind those interests.
Mm-hmm.
Before I go any further, because I have many of the questions, but I've never heard anything like that. Is that the same in much of Central America, that if you own land, you only own the topsoil and the governments own the subsoil? Or is that only in Guatemala? Does anybody know?
Jim, I think it's true in Mexico. I'm fairly certain it's true in Mexico. And it might, you know, it might have a good purpose, so that instead of some landowner becoming filthy rich because of oil or gold or whatever, it gets shared with the country, okay? But the reality is that it may be just shared among the people that already have a lot of money and that are that run the system and have their relatives and friends that they take care of, and it may not get back to the most needy people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, and another thing that is unfortunately affected by this, and this is going to be one of the major conflict issues. I mean, it already is, but it'll become worse as time goes by, is water.
Absolutely.
And so if you're affecting the water supply, either poisoning it, as has happened in Guatemala on a couple of occasions with both palm oil production and mining interests, where the local water supply has become poisoned, that's obviously going to affect these people who are just trying to live off the land in surrounding communities even, but also water drying up. And that's we've seen that in a couple places in Guatemala where major mines who perforate the ground at these unbelievable depths are hitting water tables and draining the water that these communities have lived off on for millennia. I mean, we're talking indigenous communities that have been farming communities long before the Spaniards even arrived. And now suddenly that's at even greater risk than I think it has been in the past. Incredibly complex issues.
With all of these problems that American companies have caused, and you mentioned the Dulles and United Fruit and the international mining interests, how do you find living as an American in Guatemala? Do they treat you as one of the oppressors, or are able to make contact with the people as just an ordinary person?
I am treated much better than I deserve to be treated.
Where do you live?
In Guatemala City.
Oh, you live in the city?
Yeah.
When I was there years ago, there was a Scottish guy who lived in Antigua. I don't know if he's still there. And he did a lot of work. And he said that he had found his home there and that he was never going back to Scotland. He felt he was Guatemala. Feel like you're Guatemalan?
There is something magical about Guatemala, and I'd say now that I've lived officially half of my life there that I could say I'm at least half Guatemalan. Maybe Guatemalan on the inside and gringo on the outside. But there's a true element, and I don't want to get too spiritual here, but of grace in the Guatemalan people, where they've moved far beyond this concept of gringos are bad. You know, what the U.S. Did to us in our past is bad, and can see, okay, these government policies are bad. The way that this particular U.S. company acted in the past is bad. But Guatemalan people are like U.S. people, are like Japanese people, and that is, you know, we love our families. We want the best for the future generations. We love community. And that kind of identification as people, as what they say in Guatemala is as pueblos, you know, is for me a thing of grace in that and unexpected, really, when you look at not just everything that's happened in the past, but being a white male on the middle class, upper middle class, Westchester County, a person of privilege, coming in and being invited into the homes of people who are on a day-to-day struggle for survival and being welcomed. And I mean, truly welcomed is a thing of grace. And that's, I think, one of the things that's so addictive about life in Guatemala, why it's so hard to shake off. It would be safer and easier, I think, for me to stay in New York. You get a job at Barnes & Noble, they might as well be paying me for all the time that I'm spending talking to John there. But no, I feel called to go back, and part of it is that kind of warmth and welcoming that you feel, that goes far beyond what I've earned. That's a very powerful emotion.
So no matter how we viewed then a lot of Latin American citizens that want to come and join us here now. Rob, you're the most current on the ground there. What's behind this mass migration? We haven't even touched the gangs in Guatemala and Honduras.
Yeah.
What's behind them, and why are they all coming here?
Well, like everything else we've talked about tonight, it's an extremely complex issue. Part of it is economic need. But again, you can't look at it as just a coldly, oh, these people want to earn more money. Again, you have to look at what kind of economic opportunities exist in Guatemala and why aren't there more and better economic opportunities? Why do they feel like you have to risk this horrific and incredibly expensive journey across Mexico and into the States to try to find a better life for your family? Why don't those conditions exist in Guatemala? So some of it's economic, but John, you're right, there's also a terrible crime problem in Guatemala. It's one of the most violent countries in the hemisphere, along with the Northern Triangle, really. Honduras,
Salvador,
and Guatemala, and Nicaragua, not as bad, but those three countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, are terribly violent countries.
So why can't
if you step back from the issue, a lot of it is due to the flow of drugs from South America to where? The United States again. We're talking about an extremely voracious appetite for drugs that exists in the States. It's an incredible market, and the drugs and the illicit money and the crime that goes along with that flows into these countries and takes root there. And again, so the Guatemalans say, hey, well, listen, we're not producers and we're not the users, but we're the ones who are screwed because we've got organized crime here now. We have all our politicians
in the pocket. Transshipment points. Drugs come up from maybe Peru, Colombia, and it may be that the U.S. authorities know the usual route, so that then they reroute them through a Caribbean island or a Central American country.
Exactly. Yeah, as the war on drugs
heated
up in Mexico, a lot of the cartels and the structure, the infrastructure, came down to Central America, and those became then the shipping off points, along with all the violence that goes with that.
Time,
so it's not surprising.
Time. Why can't these governments, if they care, and if they're authoritarian to begin with, to why can't they put these gangs out of business, have curfews in a town, do whatever they have to lock down the countries?
Well, in part, I think a lot of it's corruption. There's a lot of money to be had, scary money. And in Guatemala, again, where you can still eat a really decent lunch for, you know, $2, and people survive on dollars a day, this kind of narco money is crazy money. And with that, you can buy the entire police structure in the country, for example. If you, as a nation, you don't have the income to be able to pay for your police, all of a sudden, you know, they're making, I think the average police officer makes about $300 a month.
That much?
Yeah, on a good day. So we have these crime syndicates coming through, and it's very easy to buy politicians, police officers, even the army itself. And so how do you fight that kind of influence and that kind of encrusted corruption that exists?
I hear a lot about this on Univision television.
Mm.
One of the Mexican drug crime bosses put it this way: We give people, judges, politicians, policemen, an offer: plomo or plata. Plomo is lead, meaning a bullet. Plata is money. We pay you off. If you don't accept the bribe, we're going to kill you, or maybe members of your family. The stark choice. And I got to hand it to some of the countries where people have chosen, in spite of that, to try to be honest and fight it. Colombia is one. I'm sure a lot of people are bought off, but I think a lot of people have been killed and threatened and still have had the guts to fight this problem.
Yes.
In Mexico, it's horrible. You get decapitations of the kind you read about in that ISIS is carrying out in the Middle East. It's just terrible. Mm-hmm. They're better armed, they're better informed than the army or the police.
Karen, you've covered things like this over the years. Do you see any answers to any of this?
No, I think it's complicated. You know, when you talk about when the drug dealers, and you don't have to go south of the border for this, to poor neighborhoods here in the United States where drug dealers buy, you know, uniforms for the local baseball team or basketball mm-hmm. team. You know, they pass out money so that families, you know, they hear somebody's family has a problem, they intervene. So therefore you have a community support for this. And then, of course, once again, police take bribes. So, you know, it's a dangerous neighborhood, so why should you, you know, use your own life or life of your family to intercede in this? So it's a
right.
vicious circle. And
as
Jim said, there are people who nonetheless put their life on the line to try and intercede, but it's going up against a mountain.
Right.
Karen, in the U.S., we have both confusion and hostility about the flood of immigrants. What is your answer to the situation, or is there none?
I'm almost inarticulate. We have issues with people who don't see these people as people. I mean, remember years ago, the Washington Post, maybe 10 years ago, the Washington Post did something on race, black and white. So this is very simple because those are the extremes in the United States. And the people who had the least interaction with African Americans assumed that African Americans were 40% of the population. This is nowhere in basis reality. And there are people who, in the same situation, you say, you have a Donald Trump will say people are rapists and drug dealers and things like that. They don't know any of these people.
Right.
So it's much easier to take a stereotype. It's a short-term way of looking at situations. You see somebody who's not speaking English. I mean, I remember when I went down for the New York Times to take care of the bureau in Miami for a while, and there were white Americans who were just completely nonplussed because everybody around them spoke Spanish. And I remember being in a line in the drugstore where the Latinos basically got in front of everybody because they spoke Spanish. And finally I said, discúlpame, es una línea here. And they're like, oh, where are you from? Like, United States. But if we don't have a sophistication about these kinds of things, then you're going to look at a simplistic answer. What is Donald Trump wants to build this huge wall? Who's going to build it? I saw a cartoon the other day. It's going to be Latinos building it. I look around my neighborhood here in Washington, D.C., and there's nobody in the neighborhood in the middle of the day but Latinos and Filipinos. So it's a lack of sophistication on the part of Americans who do not understand how our government works, either here domestically or abroad. So, you know, when you talk about problems like how do you deal with immigrants coming from other countries or their criminal problems or their drug problems, Americans don't know how to deal with that here. For the last 40 years, people have been told no new taxes. You drive the streets of Washington, D.C., and there are places where you think you're in a developing world.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an electrical grid situation in the United States that's quite fragile. Yet people are patting me down at airports and having me take off my shoes when the reality is some really smart enemy on our electrical grid system. These are very sophisticated problems in a much more close world than we've ever lived in. So when something happens on a street in Guatemala or Nicaragua, there's, what did they say, when a butterfly flaps its wings.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what's going on now, and we have to be more. We need smart, sophisticated people, and there's no easy answers here.
Bob, you're on the and because these are complex questions, that doesn't mean you can beg off trying to find an answer to them, right? You can't shrug it off saying, well, this is just too complex. I think what Karen is saying is exactly right. Complex questions, but they need complex answers, but it's worth it. It's worth the time. It's worth the investment because it's the only way we're going to find our way out of these troubling issues.
Rob, you're on the other end of this where the people they're leaving to come up here. And I'm sure that if they had decent living conditions, and if they weren't afraid of the gangs, they'd rather stay where they grew up. Is there any hope that Guatemala can be turned into a place that the people will want to stay there?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and that would be, that's the goal, right? No one wants
all of the immigrants that you see here, take a ride in a cab in Washington, D.C. with somebody from Somalia or
right.
Ethiopia, and you say, would you rather be?
Exactly.
And then they become American, but would they be in Ethiopia if they could? Yes. If the government was stable, they'd be there. And the same with the Salvadoranians. As I said, when I first came to Washington, there were no pupuserias. They're there now because of things that happened in Salvador.
Yes,
we've got Guatemalans
exactly.
here. My housekeeper is Guatemalan. She's the daughter of somebody from Guatemala.
Guatemala still is a very family-based and a very community-based culture.
Absolutely.
It's not like the United States where we, you know, tend to, once we leave the university or leave high school, you know, we grow wings, we fly different parts of the country. That's not the case. In Guatemala, you still have generations living in the same households. And so for even one member of that family to head up to the States is devastating. To have all the males of the family head up and try to find work in the United States just to send money back to Guatemala is devastating, both for the families, children who are growing up without their fathers, in some cases without both their parents, but also for the men and the women who come up here and who face everything, every sort of danger and from nature to rape by the coyotes who bring them across, all not for personal gain, but to be able to send money back to their families, to keep their families fed and clothed and in their homes. If they could do that within Guatemala, of course, that would be the preference. Because even the trip itself to be able to get to the States, and this is because the visa system in the U.S. is simply broken. There's no way around that. There's no guest worker program. There's no legal way for these folks to get here. I've tried to get visas for Guatemalans to do speaking tours in the States and have been turned down. So trying to find a legal way to get to the States and work for a couple years to send money back to your families is almost impossible. So the short answer is yes, if conditions were better in these countries, if even the U.S. looked at investing in Guatemala and in other ways which would – in a way that would promote greater growth, but real growth, not this kind of, you know, the extractive – industries kind of concept where the communities basically get raped for 10 years or 20 years, the mine is there, and then they're gone. But a real support for the Guatemalan economy in a way that jobs become real, then there'd be no need to migrate to the United States. To throw yourself into a completely foreign culture in a country that you don't know the culture, you don't know the customs, you don't know the language. It's an incredibly brutal and dehumanizing process that these people do, all for the good of their families.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when I first was here in Mount Pleasant, Washington, D.C., which was a heavily left restaurant, there was a bar called Carlos Gardal, and they'd go there for Latin food. And there were all of these men on Friday night sitting together, drinking, and talking about their families.
Yes.
And this is, you know, they're not up here in the United States living six to a room because they somehow died in the world capitalists. But life is so hard back home. And as I said, this man from Guatemala who started Atlas Shoes, he came by himself. He left his wife and six children, and then his wife came, and who knows where he had the six children until they could bring enough money to bring each of those children up to the United States. This is an amazing story of human survival in the face of horrific things. And so when you ask about how Americans view this, most Americans don't know any of this stuff.
Right. And God bless America for offering those kind of opportunities, but let's do it in a way that, first of all, welcomes them and makes that in a way that's not such a sacrifice. But ideally, like you said, John, if there's a way that we can help support these economies so that people don't have to make this journey, all the better.
Rob, do you see yourself continuing as an expatriate the remainder of your working life, or is there a chance of burnout?
Oh, the burnout is a pretty constant companion, but no, I think I'm pretty much screwed now. I can't even imagine what life would look like outside of the Guatemalan context. And for all we've been talking about, the good and the bad that we've done, that we can do, the one thing that inspires me the most is the dedication of these activists in Guatemala who are fighting for indigenous rights, women's rights, farmers' rights, student rights, people who literally put their lives on the line every day, who have faced tremendous odds, who have been threatened, attacked, jailed for their work, and continue every single day to fight this really truly selfless effort for creating a better Guatemala, and what they'd say also a better world. Because when you're defending the environment in Guatemala, you're not just protecting the Guatemalan air, you're protecting the air that we all breathe, is one of the things I like to say. And these men and women are so incredibly inspiring that it's a pleasure and an honor just to be able to stand with them and accompany them, support them in any way that I possibly can. And I feel blessed for that. So as long as that opportunity remains open to me, I'll be in Guatemala.
What is the situation for the indigenous people? Because there was having been in Ecuador and Guatemala, the main population, even though they all have some Indian in them, they look down on these people. Is that improved in Guatemala?
Not much. No, the Mayan people are still a majority in Guatemala, and still the oppressed majority. They make up the poorest percentage of the population, the most discriminated against. During the conflict, the majority of the innocent, the civilians who were assassinated, who were massacred during the conflict, were indigenous people. And to this day, racism walks hand in hand with machoism in Guatemala. And it's
if I may make a comment or two on that.
Please.
What we haven't talked about is the history of the Mayan people and the greatness they achieved. I don't know how many centuries ago. The Mayans are one of only two groups in world history that have invented the concept of zero,
right,
which is so important in mathematics. They were great builders. If you go to a place which I think Rob has mentioned, Tikal, it's a fantastic ruin in the middle of a Petén jungle. I love the day's trip I took there. But, all of that was eliminated before the Spaniards came. That wasn't something the Europeans did. Of course, the Spaniards, might have decimated them as well. But it happened, the great Mayan culture sort of disappeared. The people didn't. And scholars have been working on an explanation as to why that happened. I don't know what the latest theory is, or if there's one that's accepted. Maybe Rob can tell us.
No, to this day, I think it remains one of the great mysteries of what actually caused the collapse of that incredible civilization. And like I said, in Tikal and other parts of Guatemala, southern Mexico, and into Honduras, these amazing pyramids that were built. They're still being excavated. To this day, they're still finding new ruins in these incredibly remote jungle areas. An amazing civilization that collapsed, and whether it was because of drought or warfare or sickness, I don't think they've agreed yet on any one cause.
Yeah. Place where there are lots of Mayan ruins is Belize or Belice.
Yes, of course, right. That's right.
And Guatemala claims Belize. They say Belize is Guatemalteco. The Belizeans want no part of Guatemala, and I don't blame them. But they have there's a ruin there at a place I can't think of name right now. But apparently they had a bigger town or development there than Tikal, maybe not more beautiful or sophisticated. It's near the border with Guatemala. But I've traveled through Belize. Like I said, the Inter-American Development Bank gave me the opportunity to travel everywhere. I did it for work purposes, but I took advantage of every spare day, evening, et cetera, to get to know the country. And one of the things I concluded in Belize is that every time you see a hill covered with vegetation,
yes,
that's just vegetation covering one more Mayan ruin.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
As you can tell, Jim is a historian on the Inwood group that we started years ago. Jim's my old neighborhood. A GI who wound up with the PhD in agricultural economics. That you retired and you devote a lot of time, obviously, to history projects and to speaking. But if you hadn't retired, if you were 15 years younger, would you have burned out, or would you have continued in Central America?
Well, I spent just 2 years in Central America, but it was an important, really important experience in my life. I continually think back to it. I've gone back in the 70s and 80s, but I haven't gone back since then. Would I have burned out if I stayed there? I don't know. It's very possible. One thing living in the United States forces you to do is continually renew yourself just to keep up with technology. Uh-huh. I might have burned out. One of the things I discovered when I went back to the States, and maybe Rob has discovered this, is that I was in Nicaragua from 1965 to 1967. I went back to the United States. That was a different United States when I left in 1965.
Sure.
They were burning cities. They were rioting over the Vietnam War. There were racial issues. I said, wow, this isn't the same country.
Rob, do you want to answer him?
Oh, no, sure. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, it's I was going to use a bad word. But I have a friend who said that when you have your life between, at least two different countries that you identify with, or you've made a life with, you are forever, let's use the word, screwed. and he says that because there are always places and people and food and customs and culture and history that you're missing once you've identified with, more than one place.
Sure.
And I guess it would even be true within the United States.
I listened to something you said. I replayed your previous interview with John, and I replayed Karen's also. I commend you both for being interesting people and excellent communicators. Now I sort of lost my train of thought. You talked about the fact that you can converse with people in Guatemala. And you don't get that kind of social warmth and interaction here in the States. I think that's very much, I agree with that. I had, with all the problems that exist in Latin America, I had great times with people. I had great times mm-hmm. talking with people. I had a great time listening to music, discovering their literature itself, their great literature, their poets, their novelists, priests intellectual like Camilo Torres. It was such an enriching experience. I couldn't have replicated it doing anything else. It was a very privileged experience,
right?
Because the bank paid my transportation, hotels, etc., to do work. I did the work, but I also had a fascinating cultural and learning experience. I just feel very fortunate.
I think that's a common denominator, right? I imagine that Karen feels the same way, that kind of just fortune to have been part of these.
I haven't been out of the country since I went back to Ethiopia during its millennium, which was in 2006. But I'm going to Cuba in December, and I'm working on my Cuban Spanish with friends. They say it's
excellent.
One thing I don't understand, Karen mentioned the people not understanding how many blacks there were in the country, and they're going to take over this 40%. Well, it's a small minority, and they were oppressed. And other minorities have been still pressed. I don't understand how when Rob says that the majority of a country is still pressed. You know, you would think that there'd be more revolutions than we ever heard of if you could organize the majority of a country.
Oh, exactly. There's all sorts of complications there. Part of it is linguistic, that when you talk about the Mayan people in Guatemala, you're talking about 23 different linguistic, different languages, but also different customs. And so as a Mayan people, there isn't that kind of unity that you might expect in other situations. But also the distance, the geography of Guatemala. But also there's been a very intentional effort to divide and oppress in Guatemala, to keep those the majority, to keep the Indians on the farm, to keep education, to keep them out of the ability to have education or access to health care, the ability to organize. And I think that's part of, when you talk about liberation theology, that's what the priest began to realize was so lacking, is very basic concepts of human dignity, of human worth, of human rights. Yeah, that's the only way I think it can keep a people, a majority, oppressed. You have to be intentional about that, and that's definitely been the case in Guatemala.
You see, I don't see, you know, earlier on, John, you talked about how we learned European history, and we didn't learn a lot of things about Central and Latin America. The reality is the English peasant were kept down for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then many of these countries are in the sort of same situation. I'm not saying that they're medieval, but they're powerful groups who are working on having power among
exactly.
themselves, not in sharing power. And that's why the United States is, in a way, an amazing place. And so is Europe now, but it took a long time for it to get down to individuals and humanism, and we're all valued. And there's still, I don't think we're all valued, even in the United States. So I think it's, as Rob said, you're in some isolated, a particular kind of Indian who speaks a particular kind of language, and you don't know the person that's at the other end. Fortunately, actually, I have to say, though, technology is beginning to change that. People have cell phones even in isolated places.
Mm-hmm.
And so social media is beginning to unite people in ways that hadn't been before.
Absolutely.
We've touched a lot of bases. Before we have to wrap up, what else would you like our audience to know about your thoughts on Latin America? Anything at all? Karen?
Well, I'm sorry we didn't touch on the Caribbean at all. We were going to talk about Latin America and Central America and the Caribbean. I've actually learned so much from you guys that I appreciate you including me in the conversation. I don't think I added very much, but I was fascinated by the history, and your expertise on Guatemala is just, it reminds me of how painful the things that I read about Guatemala were at the very beginning before I went there, and the fact that the only Spanish person who wrote about the Indians was a priest. I can't even remember his name, but
yeah, Fray Bartolomé de las Casas.
Exactly.
Yes.
On the Caribbean, Karen, there is I publish a daily newspaper that you've probably seen that I send out. It's only one email per day. There's another newspaper like that. It's called the Sun Goddess News, whatever it is. Do a search on Sun Goddess. And she's forever posting articles. She's curating articles that have to do with Haiti, with Miami Haitians, with Dominican Republic, with the islands. You might want to look at that.
I will. Thank you.
Rob, how about you? Anything at all?
Well, just my complete and utter thanks to both Jim and Karen for Karen and her extreme modesty to adding to this wonderful conversation. I also learned a lot, and I think if there's a takeaway, one of the things that I've really enjoyed working in the last 5 or 6 years in Guatemala with a particular focus on human rights. And I think what is so compelling about human rights is that it erases the distinctions, it erases the boundaries that exist between us, and it talks about, you know, the basic dignity of all humans, whether we happen to have been born in the United States or Guatemala or Nicaragua or Haiti or anywhere. And that's a very compelling argument for me, and it just rings true when you've had such wonderful experiences in cultures that aren't your own, and yet you feel you're able to identify with them so thoroughly. And I think it was interesting to hear how both Jim and Karen had their lives impacted by these cross-cultural encounters. And it's a beautiful thing. And I guess if I were to urge anything, I'd urge anyone who's listening to try to have to get out and have those encounters if you can. And like Jim said, you don't even have to go to Central America, you know, across the street and talk to the guy who's cutting the shrubs over there, and he might have some fascinating stories to tell. But that the thing is, our common humanity is a beautiful thing, an inspiring thing, and I think both Jim and Karen and of course our wonderful host John for making this conversation possible.
Thank you,
Jim. How about you?
Okay. Well, one of the things I was going to say tonight, but it sort of came up with this. It used to be Latin America was down there, south of the border. We've always had a Latin population in the United States, and including people over here before the European settlers came. I'm talking about the Mexicans that were living out in the Southwest, actually during the period of the Spanish Empire. But now, almost no matter where you go, you see Hispanics. You see them in small towns in places like Georgia, where I went to a wedding a couple of months ago. They're all over my neighborhood doing work. And our old neighborhood in Manhattan, John, is filled up with people from the Dominican Republic. So Latin America is very much up here, and there is a question: what do we do about it? When I first went back to our old neighborhood to an Inwood luncheon, I stopped by the apartment building I grew up on, 156 Sherman Avenue, and I stood gazing at the building. And I looked up towards the fifth floor. I half expected my mother to lean out the window and say, "Jimmy, come home, it's time for lunch or for dinner." I'm looking at it. Of course, I'm the only non-Latin around. The superintendent comes out, and he says to me, "Hello." I must have looked odd the way I was looking up and down the building. He said, "Can I help you with anything?" He said, "No, I was just looking up the stairs to see if my mother's going to call me for dinner." I'm joking, of course. We began talking. Well, it turns out he was a well-spoken man from the Dominican Republic, from a town that a lot of great baseball players have come from. I think it's San Pedro de Macorís or someplace like that. And we had a wonderful conversation about the way our neighborhood used to be, but about places that we both know in the Dominican Republic. And that's kind of a unique experience. But again, it drives home the fact that Latin America is very much up here with us. Now, what do we do about the problem of migration? I think, first of all, we have to recognize that every country has a right to define its own immigration policy, to expect other people to respect it. Maybe we have to redefine our policy, but we have a right to expect that these policies be respected, and we have a right to enforce that respect. On the other hand, we are very much to blame for the immigration that has occurred, because we have had a demand for the labor. And we get it's a bargain. Some of them, particularly, I hate to distinguish between groups, particularly the El Salvadorans, even in Central America, they have a reputation for hard work. I'm sure Guatemala is no different. But they have been allowed to immigrate illegally because they offer a great advantage to employers. Work hard, they work well, they don't cost very much. And their status as illegals means that they can't gripe too much. They can't demand respect by the protection from the institutions of the state. So we are very much responsible for their predicament. And I think we have to recognize the fact that they're here because implicitly they've been welcomed, even though they've come under undocumented or illegal circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that requires a fix that treats them as more than just undocumented, the term undocumented, I mean illegal. No individual is illegal. But I think the perspective has got to change. And Americans know. They know that this immigration has been tolerated and abetted. So there.
But you can add to that. You can say that even if we're only responsible for 10% of the problems in Guatemala, and it's probably closer to 70%, and X percent of the problems in Panama or whatever, if we bear some responsibility for the people wanting to get the hell out of their country, that we should understand, do we have to take some responsibility?
Sure.
Well, thank you all. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And the commercial information, my column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available on Amazon, and I blog at johnmacrants.com. That's johnmacrants. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. And as I used to say in my old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver. Whoa, steady, Silver. Steady, steady. Da 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 da